Welcome to MIT Talks. I'm Vita Bilkis.
And I'm Dana Attar. MIT Talks set out to bring you the stories that shape the people of MIT.
And I'm Sarah Trace. As the co-hosts of MIT Talks, we go behind the scenes with some of the most influential members of the MIT community, past and present, to dig deeper into their unique and inspiring journeys.
So tune in, listen, learn, and grow.
This is MIT Talks.
I'm still on my mission of taking finance into areas where we do have funding shortages and where finance can actually play a positive role.
You are listening to the MIT Talks podcast. This is your host, Dana Attar. Andrew Lowe is Charles E. and Susan T. Harris Professor, a professor of finance and the director of the Laboratory for Financial Engineering at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Lowe is also principal investigator at the MIT Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, an affiliated faculty member of the MIT Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science, an external faculty member of the Santa Fe Institute, and a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. Lowe holds a BA in economics from Yale University and an AM and PhD in economics from Harvard University. As you will find during this MIT Talks, that Andrew Lowe is an extraordinary storyteller. He can take a very complex topic, simplify it, and make it relevant to non-finance expert. This helps in extending his outreach and impact, as he's always looking for ways to use finance in a more practical way to make an impact on the world. I'm thrilled and honored to talk to Andrew Lowe today. Andrew, welcome to MIT Talks. So we're going to start with a little bit of a background. So I gave a brief introduction about your professional background and accomplishment. But here at MIT Talks, we're very interested in the person behind the accomplishment. So let's get started at the beginning. Where are you from?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show. And I originally was born in Hong Kong, left after 6 months to move to Taiwan, lived there until I was about 5 years old, and then we moved to New York City. So I grew up in New York.
So how was it growing up in New York City?
Well, it was an interesting experience. I think I went to public schools throughout. And there are some high points and low points, as you can imagine, for anybody going through the public school system. New York's got a very, very diversified school system. So we've got kids from all sorts of different backgrounds, and it was very educational from that perspective. My high school experience was particularly productive and enjoyable. I went to one of the specialized high schools, Bronx High School of Science. It's one of these schools where it's free. You don't pay any tuition. It's a public school. But you have to take an entrance exam to get in. And so that was really the first time I met classmates that were as interested in learning as I was, and where I didn't feel like I was an outlier in the system. But science, math, and engineering were the focus of that program.
Does that mean that's what you wanted to do when you grew up?
That was. I actually left high school thinking I was going to be focusing in college on either physics, math, or biology. Those are my three loves, and computer science was something that I was getting interested in. At the time, we didn't call it computer science, it was just programming. So I had a lot of fun programming computers in high school.
Wow, that must have been a very interesting experience. Then how did you end up in economics?
Well, that was a bit of a surprise to me as well. When I got to college, I had to take some courses to round out my education. In addition to science and math, you were required to take some humanities. And so I decided to take something that was as close to being a science as any of the humanities could offer, which was economics. And like I think many people have experienced in their careers, I was absolutely captivated by an incredibly inspirational set of teachers. And it was through having these incredible lecturers that I decided that economics was a subject I wanted to pursue.
I did read somewhere, I think, that you wanted to be Bob Merton when you grew up. So what type of impact did he have on your decisions?
Well, Bob was the person that first made me understand why finance was such an important and exciting subject. I took graduate courses in economics when I was an undergrad. And then when I got to grad school my first year, I was pretty disappointed to learn that the same kind of material that I covered as an undergraduate was being covered in graduate school. You know, I found these mathematical models very interesting, but not particularly realistic. And that was a frustration for me. I wanted to do something that was practical. That's why I chose economics, because I thought that the models that we had learned as an undergraduate would be just the sort of baby versions of the more practical models that we would learn in grad school. And after my first semester of my first year as a grad student, I realized that actually the models are pretty much the same and they weren't particularly practical. And so I was actually planning to leave graduate school to go to law school when I happened to sit in on a class taught by a faculty member that I'd never heard of. But one of my high school classmates who was at MIT at the time, she said, you really ought to cross register because I was a student at Harvard. She said, you really ought to cross register and sit in on this course in finance. And, you know, my reaction was finance. Why would anybody be interested in that? Isn't that like balancing your checkbook? And she said, no. It's actually got a lot of math and it's very practical. So I think you'd enjoy it. And so I was introduced to this course taught by Bob Merton. And after the first day, I realized that this is really something that I needed to learn more of and was quite excited. And after the first 2 weeks, I decided that this was going to be my career. And yes, I viewed Bob as my my role model and have been trying to live up to that ever since.
So then I must ask, I was wondering, coming from Yale and Harvard, how did you end up in MIT? So I guess that was the connection, taking that one class.
Well, that was one connection, but the bigger connection is the incredible finance franchise that Bob and many of the other MIT giants created over the course of decades before I even got there. People like Paul Samuelson, Franco Modigliani, John Cox, Myron Scholes, Fisher Black, Stu Myers, Chi-Fu Huang. I mean, there's a whole list of people that blazed the trail in finance. And I just wanted to be part of that history. I mean, it's just an incredible accomplishment to really rewrite all of the rules of modern financial analysis. And so to be part of that tradition was just an incredible honor.
And the one thing I always know in MIT that it's not a good conversation if you don't put some equation into it. So can you describe to the average listeners of, you know, what is the field of finance and then what is financial engineering, whether you use words or equation to describe that?
Well, I'm very tempted to use equations, but I think on a podcast, it's kind of hard to do that. So I will give you one equation. And the equation is one that I start with when I teach introductory finance, because there are a number of students that are required to take it, but don't know what finance is. And so the equation that I put on the board is finance equals money plus mathematics. That's it. It's basically using the ideas of quantitative analysis to think about how to manage one's financial resources. And it turns out that there's actually quite a lot of very relevant mathematics that can be applied to making the most of your money, whether it's investing in stocks or bonds, or thinking about risk management, or thinking about financing a new business. You know, when I teach introductory finance, I tell my students that finance is the most important subject that you'll ever encounter in business school. And, you know, I know that many other faculty say the same thing about their subject, but the difference is that in my case, I happen to be right. And and the reason for that is very simple. It's because no matter what you do in business, no matter what industry you pick, no matter what objective you have in mind, at some point, if you are going to focus on developing a new technology, some kind of innovation, at some point, you're going to need money to finance that transaction. And that's where finance comes in. Finance is the language with which we discuss business opportunities. And so if you can't speak finance, you're going to have a very hard time being able to communicate with all of the relevant stakeholders, no matter what you decide you want to accomplish.
Yeah, they couldn't agree more. And it's that, you know, a lot of people think of finance as more of just math and equations, but there's a qualitative sides to it as well, to use your common sense to connect the dots. And I think that's where the magic happens, probably.
Well, that's right. And that's where the engineering happens. See, one of the things I love about MIT is that, and there are many universities, of course, that are excellent with, you know, brilliant faculty and wonderful students. But the thing about MIT that I find special is the fact that it is at its very core an engineering school. Now, of course, we have many other disciplines and many other departments that are represented across those disciplines. But because MIT was founded with the motto, mens et manus, what does that mean? Mind and hand. It means that it's not good enough to come up with interesting theories. We actually want to see them work. We want to see them applied. And this notion of mens et manus applies across the board to every single field that MIT touches, including finance. So people like Paul Samuelson, Bob Merton, Bob Solow, Franco Modigliani, the giants that really established the field of modern quantitative finance, they didn't just talk about these ideas. They actually were involved in implementing them in various different ways. And that's really exciting. It's exciting to see your work come alive and actually affect other people's lives.
Now, I would like to move to a different topic, which is talk about your latest book that came out in 2017, The Adaptive Markets. So it's the financial evolution of the speed of thoughts. So if you were to explain this to a non-finance expert, how would you describe that? And can you talk about the significance of the theory that you have in that and how it modernized and changed the way we would look at finance?
Well, sure. It was a bit of a labor of love, hate in terms of the length of time it took me to put that book together, but also in terms of how I came to these ideas. In finance, we have a very important idea known as the efficient markets hypothesis. And this was developed by Eugene Fama, who won the Nobel Prize for this idea, as well as Paul Samuelson in an unrelated context a few years earlier on the random walk and looking at how stock market prices are anticipated. Because if you've got a good idea, and you think that it's going to affect the value of a stock, you're going to trade on that idea. And the very act of trading makes that idea change the price of the stock. And if it happens very quickly, then in fact, all these good ideas are already impounded in stock market prices. They're already in the prices. So the argument of efficient markets is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to make money trading in financial markets, because if you can make money doing it, well, somebody else could do that as well, and they would have already done it. And so the idea behind efficient markets that prices fully reflect all available information, it's actually a very powerful idea that is a remarkably good approximation to reality. It actually works much of the time. And that's one of the reasons why Eugene Fama rightly won the Nobel Prize for this brilliant innovation. But it doesn't always work all the time. It breaks down periodically because people are not only rational creatures, we also happen to be emotional creatures. And it was that emotional side that really caught my attention, because I like working with data. And when I was a grad student and as an assistant professor, I tried to test out some of these theories, like the random walk hypothesis, the idea that stock market prices look like a drunkard's walk. You can't predict where it's going to be based upon where it was. And so I tested the theory with my co-author, Craig McKinley, at the Wharton School. That's where we were at the time. And actually found that the theory does not work, that you can reject the hypothesis using historical data. And it took me about 10 years to really come to terms with that fact. I tried to explain it away in all sorts of different ways by using, you know, market frictions as an excuse, or looking at the way we estimate the statistical properties and trying to rule out biases. And by the end of that process, I had no choice but to conclude that, you know what, the data is right. The stock markets that we look at don't follow random walks. And so that led me probably to another five-year period where I started looking into behavioral finance, psychology, neuroscience, evolutionary biology, computer science, to try to understand how humans actually think. How do we make decisions? Are we always rational? When are we emotional? And ultimately, that gave rise to what I call the adaptive markets hypothesis. In a way, it's kind of a generalization of efficient markets. It basically says that, yeah, markets are efficient most of the time, but when certain environmental forces lead us to react in highly emotional ways. For example, in the midst of a pandemic, or if we have some kind of a financial crisis, as in 2008, during those episodes, markets will not behave normally. And you need a different theory to account for those kinds of exceptions. And that's where looking at markets, not as a physical system, but as a biological system, using the ideas of evolutionary biology and ecology, can give us a better sense of how markets actually move over time. So that's the adaptive markets hypothesis in a nutshell.
And that's amazing, because I assume that was not, as you mentioned, is not an easy journey, I think, to challenge your fundamental thoughts of what is that the theory is based on and what you learned and grew up on, and be able to challenge that. So I assume that journey had a lot of challenges and ups and downs. And also, when you probably brought it up to the market, probably not everybody in the industry ran with an open arms accepting the idea. So any lesson learned that came out of that? And I also can think of possibly that journey had also personal aspects to it, not just the professional side.
Absolutely. That's why, as I said, it was a process of love-hate, because I love learning new things, but I hated the fact that I was dragged out of my comfort zone. I'm an economist by training and trade. I love economics, and that's what I chose to dedicate my career to. And I couldn't understand why economics was not able to explain the kind of anomalies that I was seeing in the data. It really frustrated me. And so I was dragged kicking and screaming, studying these other fields that I knew nothing about. I'm not a psychologist, but I ended up reading a fair amount of psychology papers and having to learn psychology to understand how it is that the psychologists think about rationality. And then it turns out that psychology was heavily influenced by neuroscience and imaging studies of the brain and how different components of the brain interact with each other. So it was really a very long journey that took me to lots of different fields, many of which I had no expertise in. And so it took me a while to be able to get up to speed, just to learn the vocabulary, and then to be able to understand the research that used that kind of vocabulary. But at the end of it, I feel very satisfied, because I believe that the adaptive markets hypothesis is a coherent, internally consistent, and complete framework for thinking about market dynamics. I now understand what happened with GameStop, for example, when most rational financial theories would say that having a stock veer so far away from fundamental values can never happen. Not only can it happen, it did happen, and it is happening even to this day. And so using this broader framework, it makes more sense to me now, all of these various kinds of market disruptions. And it allows me to think about what kind of policies are needed in order to regulate financial markets more effectively. So in that sense, I think, you know, it's been very satisfying, but it's not a journey that I may have undertaken had I known how long and difficult it was going to be at the outset.
I want to move to another topic that you've in the last few years focused on. So there's almost 10 million people die every year from cancer worldwide. That's about 26,000 people a day, as one in every six deaths a day is caused by cancer. So it's a true health problems across the world. And there's so many people affected by that. And many of us are. You have mentioned in the past that you have a personal relationship with the story of cancer and why you're focused on it. And you took a really interesting angle to solve that problem. So you set out to address major issues in early stage of a drug development and what you refer to as the valley of death. Can you share with us your approach to the problem? How was or is your proposed solution working, and where you're at in the journey of building that model now?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, first of all, you know, as a matter of disclaimer, I always state at the outset when we talk about this topic that I am no biomedical expert by any means. I've learned a lot of the terminology that cancer specialists use in order to be able to communicate with them more effectively. But at the end of the day, I am not a cancer specialist. The way that I got interested in this area was within a space of 4 years, six people that were close to me, including my mother, one of my MIT colleagues, one of my lab administrators, next door neighbor, childhood friend, within 4 years, six people close to me all died of cancer. And it was really a huge wake-up call for me that I had been living in a rather blessed existence, completely unaware of this terrible affliction. And, you know, during those 4 years, I have to tell you that there were moments where I felt like somehow knowing me caused cancer, because there were so many people around me that were dying from this disease. And then I realized that, in fact, this is a universal killer. Everybody has been touched by cancer, either directly or indirectly through a friend or a family that they've lost. And so as part of that process, I tried to learn a little bit more about what my friends and family were going through, just to be sympathetic to them, to help them. And I have to say that I was really kind of helpless in knowing what to do. I did all the wrong things with Charles Harris, who is the donor of my chair. I remember speaking to him about his cancer and feeling very awkward, not knowing what to say to him. And initially, I wouldn't even talk about it with him, even though I knew that he wanted to talk about it, because I didn't know what to say. And so I learned actually from him. He was just an incredibly rational individual about dealing with his own cancer treatments. And he was very open about talking about it. I learned from him that actually finance plays a remarkably important role in drug discovery. You know, it shows how ignorant I was about this whole process. I just thought that, you know, if there was a patient need and there was a great scientific discovery that could meet that need and help that patient, then magically the money would appear to develop that drug. And I realized, quite to my shock, that that's just so far from the truth, that there are many really great ideas and potentially really good drugs that never get into the clinic, that never reach a patient, because of the way that they're financed and because of the business models. And when I learned that, I decided right then and there, that's something that I could do something about. I could actually make a contribution and help out the amazing doctors and scientists and engineers who are developing these therapeutics. So that's what I've been doing over the last 10 years now, is applying my knowledge of financial engineering to biomedical contexts and using these ideas to come up with better ways of developing drugs, better ways of organizing businesses, so we actually get better drugs to patients faster. And one example of that is portfolio theory, you know, reducing the risk of investing in drug development projects so that investors are more comfortable with those risks and are willing to put more money into the system. So just that simple idea alone of reducing the risk by using portfolio theory, which again is not original to me. That was an idea first promoted by Harry Markowitz, who won the Nobel Prize for that idea of portfolio theory. That's something that I think is a very powerful idea that has already demonstrated value in a number of contexts in biomedicine.
I know you said that this is not a new theory, but I think the way you applied it, it's kind of opened a lot of eyes about how else we can solve these problems, like because of only 5% of the drugs actually succeed in it. And if I remember correctly, I think it's also your focus on like the early stage of development, because that's where the hardest part of the development is, to get the funding.
Exactly. So the valley of death that people refer to in this industry, it really is at the preclinical to phase one stage of drug discovery. And the reason that there is this valley of death, even today, given how much money is sloshing around the system, and there's a tremendous amount of money today, much more so than there was 10 years ago when I first started studying the subject. Even with all the money that there is today, the early stages of preclinical drug discovery is starved for cash. There are many more ideas that these biomedical innovators are coming up with than there is money to explore those ideas. And so I think that the early stages are where financial innovation is most needed. And that's where I've been focusing my efforts. It's coming up with innovative models to finance early stage drug development in a way that would reduce the risk and increase the reward for investors so that they put more money to work in that space.
And I think of many problems around the world that we have today that have a similar, probably, problems to the cancer developments, where it's long time to pay off and it requires a lot of funds. So do you foresee this model used in other ways to solve some of the world problems?
Absolutely. So in addition to work that we're doing at MIT on healthcare-related issues, we're also studying applications to other areas like climate finance, thinking about fusion energy, all sorts of social impact kinds of applications, because there are so many situations where it's pretty clear that from the private sector's point of view, there isn't a very attractive rate of return, but yet the public sector return is tremendous. And so if you can figure out a way to restructure the business model so that the private sector can share in some of the benefits that society will achieve, if, for example, we're actually able to develop some kind of a bioengineered solution to precipitate greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere and reduce the kind of climate change phenomenon that we've been observing over the course of the last several decades, if there's a way for the private sector to benefit from that, then that will create enough incentives to bring the money to bear on solving some of these really urgent issues. So yeah, our idea is to basically apply these financial engineering concepts across the board to achieve the greatest societal impact for the issues that are most pressing in the day.
So I'm going to move to a topic that every conversation must have these days, which is the topic of COVID. You know, just thinking of back in the last year where literally we shut down the economy in early 2020, the employment rate shot up the roof, I mean, 13% plus. So looking back at the challenges and the opportunities of the past year, how do you see COVID changing our financial behavior of industries, and which one most benefited from these changes that happened, or which one came out actually on the losing side of it? Because I know we've seen some industry rise, some of them actually fall apart. So any surprises of what the pattern that you've seen in the past year?
Well, there's so much to be said about COVID. I'm not quite sure where to begin. So let me just throw out a few random thoughts and happy to discuss in more detail. So first, there are the direct impact of COVID on the pharmaceutical and biotech industries. That's something that's worthy of discussion, because prior to COVID, we were not investing, as a society, we were not investing enough resources in developing vaccines and anti-infective agents. And the reason for that was pretty simple. There wasn't enough incentive for the private sector to do that. I'd been working on a paper that had a very hard time getting published prior to the pandemic that looked at this problem from a very simple financial perspective. If you did a simulation of a business model where you put together a portfolio of vaccines, it turns out that no matter how large that portfolio is, no matter how diversified you are, we could not get a reasonable rate of return in our simulations from that example. And the reason for that is that vaccines cost about as much to develop as a cancer drug, same cost of clinical trials, you're paying $35,000 to $50,000 a patient per trial. But at the end of the day, the profits from vaccine business are just not as great as for cancer. And the reason is pretty simple. Governments don't want to pay for developing vaccines if there's not a pandemic. If there isn't an outbreak of chikungunya or Zika or Ebola, you're not going to get governments to buy vaccines to stockpile them, even though, in my opinion, they should. And so as a result, you can't make a business argument for developing a vaccine unless you're in the midst of an epidemic or a pandemic. And given how long it takes in the past to develop these vaccines, that really wasn't feasible from a business model perspective. So, you know, prior to the pandemic, during the previous 10 or 20 years, more and more pharma companies were getting out of the vaccines business. And so now that the pandemic has hit and we understand the kind of devastation in terms of patient lives and the economy, now that we understand that impact, governments are going to be a lot more willing to provide the kind of resources to develop and to stockpile these kinds of vaccines. So that's the good news. In terms of the broader economy, COVID has also had some very, very important implications. Obviously, the losers in the short run are the service industry, because clearly we've had to shut down the economy. So restaurant workers and other people that were involved in providing services to consumers, they were in very, very difficult shape, and they still are right now. On the other hand, the kind of online services like Zoom has been tremendously helped by the pandemic and will likely continue to do well as we go to a new world, a new economy, where much of the activity that was done in person will be done online. So I think that there are a lot of winners and losers from this. And I think that's true of any kind of huge dislocation. The evolutionary biologists have a concept called punctuated equilibrium. This is an idea that was first proposed by Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould. The idea is that when there's a huge cataclysm in the environment, that clearly creates a lot of winners and losers in terms of the species that are able to adapt versus those that can't. And you know, one of the reasons that humans, Homo sapiens, now dominate the environment was because of what happened 65 million years ago, that asteroid that hit the planet and blocked out the sunlight, killed the plants, killed the dinosaurs. That really allowed mammals to emerge as the dominant species in this era. And so that same kind of cataclysm occurred in a number of different situations in the economy. 2008 financial crisis, one is an example. But the current pandemic is the most recent example. And there will be a whole new set of species that will come out of this. Companies like Zoom that are involved in supporting the type of interactions that we will be engaging in going forward. And some of the more traditional businesses will be hit hard and may not come back. So I think that process is going to be happening over the course of the next year or two as we adapt to this new normal. But in the end, I think what it'll mean is the economy in general will be stronger, more robust. And I think that over the course of the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to see tremendous economic growth. It's already happening now, but I think it's going to continue for years to come.
It's interesting that you think it's in a 5-10 years. So you think the economy will grow faster coming out of this pandemic than it did from the 2008 financial crisis.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the two?
Sure. So 2008 was a financial crisis. The problems that we are still dealing with today are problems that came out of the mortgage lending business and the fact that we created all sorts of additional businesses on top of it that were just not sustainable. And as U.S. residential real estate rose through the financial innovations that have occurred, we all benefited. But once the real estate market started to go down, everybody ended up getting hit with these various different dislocations that came out of the subprime mortgage meltdown. 2020 and 21 were very, very different in terms of the impact of the pandemic. Because at its core, the pandemic is not a financial crisis. It is a public health crisis that has had financial implications. So during the first month after the pandemic hit U.S. shores, from middle of February to middle of March, stock market declined tremendously. And there was a lot of concern because nobody understood exactly what was going on. But by June, markets had recovered. And as of now, we are higher than we were pre-pandemic. And if you looked at the data and you snipped out those 4 or 5 months in between when the pandemic started, you would say, wow, the stock market is on a tear and we're continuing to grow as if nothing had happened. So that's a key sign that the pandemic, as devastating as it has been, as incredible as the loss of lives that we've experienced has been, the fact is that from an economic point of view, it was a temporary event, and we've already recovered in terms of the stock market value. And over the course of the next few months, we're going to see even more economic recovery. It doesn't mean that people's lives weren't permanently affected by this terrible tragedy. Clearly, we've lost a tremendous number of lives, and people that were thrown out of work, many of them will have a very hard time finding work again. But it is the way of the new economy that the weakest will be winnowed out and the strongest businesses will survive. And hopefully with government policy, we'll be able to deal with those that have not been able to adapt as quickly and that need that kind of help.
So now to wrap up our conversation on the MIT Talks, we always like to ask our guests the 3 signature questions. First question would be, what is one book that you think everybody should read?
The non-finance book that I recommend for everybody to read is a book called Grasp by my colleague Sanjay Sarma. This is a book that I wish I had read before I designed my online course because it really provides tremendous amounts of insight into what students are looking for from an educational experience and how we can use our technology platform to do much better for them than we have in the past. Now, obviously, Sanjay is no stranger to the technology. He heads up our open learning initiative at MIT. And so he's very familiar with the kind of tools that we use in online teaching, but he's actually taken it to another level in his book by talking about the underlying neuroscience behind how we learn and therefore how we interact with students in ways that are sometimes counterproductive to their natural method of learning. So I've learned a tremendous amount about how to teach from this book, and I recommend it to everybody who has anything to do with students.
Now, if you are to use one word to describe each of your past, present, and future, what would they be?
The past is fortunate. The present is motivated. And the future is hopeful. I feel very fortunate to have the past that I have in terms of the wonderful teachers, mentors, and my mother, who I think is largely responsible for whatever I've achieved in this life. I'm very fortunate. I'm very motivated now because I've just spent so much time learning about how finance can have an impact on society, I'm really motivated to take those ideas and put them to practice. And as a result, I'm actually very hopeful for the future because I encounter some of the most brilliant students at MIT. They are our future. And I'm just so excited to see that they're taking the ideas that we describe in our classes and actually implementing them in ways that I could never have imagined.
Now, last question would be, would you rather have a library full of books or a contact list full of names?
Well, that's also a tough one. But, you know, since I'm an introvert, I actually love my books and I still actually like physical copies. I don't read books on tape or on iPads or other tablets. I actually have a library with lots of shelves and lots of books. So I guess I would have to opt for that. But I would hope to have at least a few contacts to share my my love of books with.
So for closing, I wanted to ask you, which world of problems you think that you're going to be tackling next?
Well, I think that I'm still on my mission of taking finance into areas where we do have funding shortages and where finance can actually play a positive role. So I think that healthcare has been a very rewarding experience for me. I'm now starting to focus on issues of climate change as well as fusion energy, because those are areas where clearly technology plays a tremendous role, but the financing is challenging because you're talking about multi-decade type of timeframes. And any time where you have a situation where you're going for these so-called long shots, things that take a long time, they take a lot of money, and there's a lot of risk, that's where finance can play a positive role. So I'm hoping that some of the work that we're doing now, we're starting to just look at climate finance and starting to look at fusion energy. I'm hoping that finance can play a positive role there as it has in healthcare.
And I want to ask you about any final words.
Well, I guess I would say that for most people that are listening, finance is a means to an end, not an end unto itself. And it's important to remind the people that are in the financial sector of that, including myself. From time to time, I get so caught up in these financial theories and applications that we actually forget that we're using finance to achieve certain purposes for humans. And it's very easy to lose sight of that important fact. And certainly in healthcare, I've seen that happen on a number of occasions by entrepreneurs and investors that are so focused on what they're doing day to day that they forget about the patient and the people that are going to benefit. So if there's one thing that I would leave for all the listeners, it's to think about the ultimate objectives of what you're working on, that we are all focused very intently on the present. But from time to time, it's good to stick up our heads and try to understand exactly what the end goals are. And I think if we do that from time to time, we're much more likely to achieve the goals that we really want.
This has been a spectacular conversation, Andrew. Thank you for being our guest today on the MIT Talks. And I look forward for what you're going to come back with us in the future of more books, maybe, and new ventures.
Thank you very much, Dana.
Thank you for joining us for another inspiring episode of MIT Talks.
We would love to hear from you, our listeners. Engage with us at MIT Club of Boston's website or any of our social media channels.
Please send us your ideas for future podcast guests or reach out to further the conversation with your awesome co-hosts.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Talks.